move to the second case this morning, Benya Wheatfield versus Cohen. Ms. Bedford Barnes.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Bedford Barnes, and I represent Mr. Benya Wheatfield, the plaintiff below and appellant. This is a case about a man who was incarcerated for 1.5 years longer than he should have been because he refused to sign a form. This was not a form that he was required to sign, and he did sign this form shortly thereafter. At issue in this appeal are claims under the First Amendment and the Eighth Amendment against defendants Betsy Spiller and Warden Donald Gates. Mr. Wheatfield should have been released from prison on January 7th, 2010. He was not released because he refused to sign an electronic detention program agreement, or what we've referred to in our briefing as the EDPA. But the EDPA is not a form that Mr. Wheatfield was required to sign. Electronic monitoring was a condition of Mr. Wheatfield's mandatory supervised release. Electronic detention, which is what the EDPA concerns, was not. On its face, this form did not apply to him. Relevant statutes and the regulations are clear. This was not a form that Mr. Wheatfield was actually required to sign. And the defendants
don't
argue.
Didn't it say at the top that it was for sex offenders?
It does say at the top that it's for, or rather that the section, that section of the form applies to sex offenders.
Which he was not.
Which he was not. That's correct. And the conditions which it speaks to on the page that he was provided only speaks to sex offenders.
So what do we do with the fact that let me put it this way. What would your response be if it appeared that Spiller was just making a good faith mistake about what the law was, thought that people leaving prison in Mr. Wheatfield's situation needed to sign this form, and therefore took the actions that she took?
Well, Spiller was on notice that Mr. Wheatfield was claiming that he didn't have to sign this form. She was provided with the information. Mr. Wheatfield made very clear that his claim was that he did not have to sign this form, and she was the IDOC employee who was responsible in this instance for release procedures. She supervised the employees that were responsible for release procedures, and she was brought in on that day to deal with this issue. So she was the one who's supposed to have the knowledge to figure out whether or not he needs to sign this form. And he made it clear he didn't think he needed to sign the form. He made it clear then again in his January 11th grievance that he did not believe this form applied to him. And at that point, once Spiller's on notice that of the possibility that he doesn't need to sign this form as a precondition for his release, she then has a duty to go and either figure that out for herself, or if she can't, go to someone else who can to forward this on and make sure that was done. And she conducted no investigation into whether this was actually a form that was required to be signed.
Now, can I take it that that the fact that this dispute about whether the form had to be signed or not was understood to be a form of protected First Amendment activity, that we aren't here needing to worry about whether Mr. Wheatfield was entitled to say, it's my belief I don't have to sign this form? Of course, they don't give him the full form anyway. They only give him this signature page, so he doesn't know what he's signing.
Yeah, that's right. The district court accepted that this was a protected speech. His refusal to sign this form is protected speech. That hasn't been argued on appeal. I don't believe that's before this court.
Mm-hmm. With regard to Ms. Spiller, did she have any personal involvement in declaring Wheatfield to be an MSR violator?
So Spiller was the one who initiated the process of him being declared an MSR violator. The idea that his conduct violated MSR appears to have originated with defendant Spiller. Spiller told Mr. Wheatfield on January 7th that if he didn't sign the form, he was going to be declared an MSR violator. This is notwithstanding the fact that he had not yet been released on MSR. And then on that same day, a person in the office that Spiller supervises recalculated his sentence on a form for MSR violators. And this occurred days before he was actually charged with having violated a term of his MSR. And then when Spiller answered his grievance on January 12th, she stated that he had violated the terms of his MSR. So that's where this idea comes from, it seems, that Mr. Whitfield violated the terms of his MSR. The formal determination that he'd violated the terms of his MSR was not made by Spiller.
So we're getting to the personal involvement question, because the way that it's been described in terms of her role, her part in the process was an interaction with Mr. Whitfield with regard to the form. What I'm trying to determine is whether or not she had personal involvement in the circumstance such that Whitfield served more time than he needed to. Do we know the answer to that?
Well, she was the one who made the decision not to release him on January 7th. So the basis that she was not releasing him was because he hadn't signed this form, and she believed that to be a violation of his MSR conditions. In fact, he didn't need to sign this form and could have been released.
So could I just interrupt and say, so if your answer is at least on January 7th, she was, in fact, the person directly responsible, whether her direct responsibility accounted for only a week extra time incarceration, or whether it accounted for the full 18 months, or whether it accounted for something in between a week and 18 months, would probably more go to a damages issue than it would a personal involvement issue.
I would agree with that, yes.
And if she has that role, what role does Gates have then? He's the warden, right?
Well, so with respect to Gates, our argument with respect to Gates is that he's personally involved in the term of disciplinary segregation and his receiving commissary restriction and grade C status. We are not otherwise arguing that Gates is involved here.
I saw very little direct evidence of Gates's involvement. He says things like, well, I like to keep track of who's in disciplinary segregation, but it sounded very much like a management perspective, not that he was the one calling the shots. So, I mean, Spiller, I can see your argument, but Gates is just being the warden, isn't he?
Well, I agree that Spiller is a much more central player here. And with respect to Warden Gates, Warden Gates, his testimony, I think a reasonable jury could conclude from that he knew of Mr. Whitfield's placement in segregation, and he knew the reason for this placement in segregation. He also testifies that he approves of the use of disciplinary segregation as a punishment for a person who refuses to sign an electronic detention program agreement.
But you're not making a Monell argument about an unconstitutional policy or primary decision maker. It's all direct liability, right?
That's correct. Everything is direct liability, and the focus is certainly principally on Spiller's behavior here.
If Spiller is the decision maker, you say, who resulted in Whitfield being declared MSR violator, what role does the Prison Review Board have?
Well, the Prison Review Board did make a determination that Mr. Whitfield had violated the terms of his MSR on February 25th. But I think it's important to understand the context there. Mr. Whitfield effectively won at that PRB hearing. They declared him an MSR violator, but they determined that he could be released at that time. And they had no real incentive to reach out and say, oh, you know, Spiller made a mistake back on January 7th, and you should have been released then. And also, it's the case that you're free now. So the issue was essentially moot at that point.
Wasn't it by that time the fact that the slot at Henry House had been taken by somebody else or closed up? I don't know whatever happened to it, but it was unavailable. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. It was between the time between January 7th and that hearing. At some point, his slot at the Henry House was lost.
And you have a different argument against Spiller for failing to find him an alternative place, is that right?
That's true.
But all still part of the same, just she was responsible for some period of, I'm going to keep that a little bit open-ended, but some period of additional detention.
That's correct. So we're arguing also that Spiller was responsible for the delay in his release plan following the approval by the Prisoner Review Board on February 24th, which would have allowed him to have a release location in finding him a release location. So Spiller was in charge of the office, which is whose responsibility it is to locate an inmate, a release location. And Spiller went and told Mr. Whitfield after it was approved by the PRB that he could be released, told him that the IDOC employees were intentionally delaying his release plan because they were angry that he had not signed the EDPA.
And this gets to your legal argument, if I'm not mistaken, because you have argued, as I understand this, that the district court wasn't applying the correct standard to the First Amendment aspect of this case, which is just whether these things would deter a person of ordinary firmness, and instead looking at something that looks much more like, you put me in administrative detention and I shouldn't have been there from a due process point of view.
I'm sorry, Judge, could you restate the question?
Well, the point is that the burden on his rights for the First Amendment relates only to whether these allegedly retaliatory actions would deter somebody from expressing himself in the way that Mr. Whitfield did, whereas the district court was looking for some substantial and different nature of his incarceration, which belongs to a different constitutional provision.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court was applying the 14th Amendment analysis of whether there had been a deprivation of due process, which is a fundamentally different question.
Right. Okay.
So I'd like to talk for a moment about Spiller's failure to investigate Mr. Whitfield's prolonged incarceration. Under this circuit's precedent, it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment to incarcerate an inmate without penological justification, which includes ignoring a risk that an inmate is held without penological justification. And so Spiller both had notice that Mr. Whitfield was claiming he didn't need to sign the EDPA. This was clear in his grievance, where he specifically stated that he asked Spiller whether she was aware of any basis which authorized her to detain him beyond his term if he refused to sign the EDPA. It was Spiller's responsibility to determine whether he signed the EDPA or whether he could be released on January 7th as the supervisor of the staff in charge of release procedures. And her job duties and the role that she assumed in the administration was one where she was responsible for correcting this issue. And all of the bases that she provides for her alleged reasonable basis for believing that he had to sign it, they fall flat. They don't make sense. The PRB order itself only states that he was subject to electronic monitoring. It says nothing about a signature requirement. It says nothing about electronic detention, which this form related to. And the statute, which she cites to, specifically states that it applies to electronic detention and does not apply to persons subject to electronic home monitoring. And I'd like to, if I can, reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Schroff.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Alexandrina Schroff, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of Betsy Spiller, Donald Gates, and the other defendant appellees. Defendant Spiller and Gates were minimally involved in Mr. Whitfield's release from custody, and as such, the district court properly granted summary judgment to them for three reasons.
But that may be, can I just say, I mean, that may be true of Warden Gates, but Spiller seems to have played a central role in the key determinations about this program. And before you get too far, I understood you in your briefs to be conceding that requiring an EDPA signature as a condition of release was in fact a mistake. It was contrary to Section 5885 of the Illinois statutes. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And we have to look at what Ms. Spiller was thinking at the time.
Well, no, let's just the objective question, whether she made a mistake or whether she was being vindictive, you know, that's a whole different inquiry. And I understand that. But I understood you to say that it was a mistake, that it's not correct to say that 730 ILCS section 5/5885 requires an inmate signature in this situation. And I would add, when I think of the number of cases I've seen over the years where people sign forms and they don't bother to read the form, or they just sign the last page and the court says, tut, tut, you know, you should read what's in front of you. Mr. Whitfield was pretty reasonable to say, I don't want to sign a blank check. I need to be able to at least to read the full form before I understand what I'm agreeing to. That seems eminently reasonable to me.
Your Honor, even if it was not required of Mr. Whitfield to sign this form, it was a reasonable interpretation. It's not completely clear from the statute alone that he was required to sign this form. And I want to clarify a factual point before I get too much further into the argument that I think really has gotten a little bit lost in the briefing of this issue, that when we look to the conversation that Mr. Whitfield had with Ms. Spiller on January 7th, and also what he complained about specifically within his January 11th grievance, was primarily that he did not think that he was required to be on electronic monitoring whatsoever. And so his complaints of having to sign the electronic monitoring document stemmed from the fact that he didn't think that he was required as a condition of his mandatory supervised release to be on electronic monitoring at all.
So why is that an occasion for punishment as opposed to simply saying, you've raised a question, we're going to look into it, you know, maybe there's going to be a postponement of a week, but we're not going to suddenly throw you in solitary confinement for raising a good faith question about what exactly the terms of release will be. Is it the position of the state of Illinois that inmates have no right to make sure that they're being released on correct terms?
No, Your Honor, that's not the position of the state of Illinois. The issue is that Mr. Whitfield, at the time of these conversations with Ms. Spiller, didn't provide any reason to contradict those sentencing orders that she relied on here.
He points to the signature page, which certainly doesn't seem to pertain to his situation. Now, maybe he was mistaken himself, you know, but why, as a matter of the exercise of his First Amendment rights, you're prohibiting from even having this conversation is what you're arguing for.
No, I don't think that that's the case, Your Honor, because if you look to both the circuit court order and the corresponding prisoner review board order, it was mandated that his mandatory supervised release was subject to electronic monitoring. And at the time of his conversation on January 7th and also his grievance on January 11th, his primary complaint was that he wasn't supposed to be on electronic monitoring whatsoever.
But you're, as I understand Mr. Batdorf Barnes, he seems to be drawing a distinction between electronic monitoring generally and this particular electronic detention program agreement more specifically. And you seem to be conflating them. So I would like some clarification there.
Well, I think that I apologize, Your Honor, did I cut you off?
No, not at all.
No, I think that we have to look at them together, because we have to look at what Ms. Spiller knew at the time of her actions. And when we look at what she knew at the time of her actions, his primary complaint was that he did not believe that he was supposed to be on electronic monitoring, period. And if we look to what she knew at that particular point, we have the circuit court order, which mandated that he was subject to electronic monitoring, and we have the corresponding prisoner review board order.
No, I understand that, but he would be subject to, I'm thinking of like federal prison, he would be subject to electronic monitoring without signing a piece of paper that says, and I know I'm subject to electronic monitoring. We release prisoners, the BOP releases prisoners all the time, and there are conditions of supervised release, and that's imposed by the court. It's not there because the prisoner or now the person who's been released has agreed. You know, he's worried that he's being asked to sign something that he doesn't think applies to him, and he could be then held to have waived rights. He could be then held to any number of conditions that he doesn't even know about.
Your Honor, that may be the case, but I think we also have to look at what is the specific deprivation upon which Mr. Whitfield is basing these claims. And I think it's important to focus that he is basing these claims on the segregation that he was sent to following the ticket, and also the 3 months of segregation.
Exactly. His claims are the punishment he receives for raising a good faith dispute about the conditions of his release. And exactly. The state says, no, you're forbidden to have, you have no right to ask a question, is what the state is saying. You have no right to make sure that there isn't any mistake in the papers.
Your Honor, I think we have to look to what was Ms. Spiller's role in that. And when we look to what her role was in the time that Mr. Whitfield spent in segregation, we can see that she was not responsible for any of the time that Mr. Whitfield actually spent in segregation. So if we bring this back to
this personal responsibility. Sure she was. She was the one who originally says, if you don't sign this, I'm going to write up a ticket on you, and you're off he goes immediately to segregation. There's no intervening person.
Well, Your Honor, if we look to what she specifically testified at deposition, she did not say that she was the person who wrote the ticket. In fact, it was a different officer who wrote the disciplinary ticket, and she also testified at deposition.
But she instructed that officer to write the ticket.
While she may have instructed the officer to write the ticket, Your Honor, she was not responsible for determining whether or not an inmate, such as Mr. Whitfield, is taken to segregation after a disciplinary ticket is issued. She testified at deposition that that's not her responsibility, that it is not within her power to do, and nor is it within her power or her role to participate in the adjustment committee hearing, which ultimately sentenced him to 3 months in segregation. And in addition to that, I do want to note that when it comes to the 3 months that he spent in segregation following the adjustment committee hearing, I think it's important to note that in their decision, the adjustment committee specifically noted that Mr. Whitfield had a Class X felony on his record, and therefore was required to be on electronic monitoring pursuant to that. So
you still haven't answered my question, though, about the distinction between the electronic detention program agreement. What does that add to a general requirement of electronic monitoring, if anything?
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes to the general paperwork that inmates are required to sign upon release. And it wasn't a matter of...
But why is it an agreement then? Is it an agreement? I just don't understand what this program adds.
Your Honor, the program adds that the inmate acknowledges that they are going to be subject to the terms and conditions of their electronic monitoring. It isn't a question as to whether or not he was required to be on electronic monitoring. That wasn't at issue. And that's the information that Ms. Spiller had before her when she had these conversations. And I think it's important to note the limited nature of her involvement in this case. What she had before her at the time was his chief complaint that he was not supposed to be on electronic monitoring whatsoever. And yet she has these two orders that state that he is required to be on electronic monitoring. And that's even buttressed by the adjustment committee hearing.
But all that means, is, I mean, she never looks into the statute. She never looks into, I mean, because what he's saying, though, is I'm not signing this piece of paper. Of course, he eventually does. 13 days later, he signs it. And she, somewhat vindictively, apparently, says, yeah, but he already committed the violation. Let's leave him, you know, in segregation. Let's, you know, even though he had by that time, which the committee noted, by that time, he had fixed the whole problem. And the committee says, fine, you're still eligible for mandatory supervised release, et cetera. But she pursues him, notwithstanding the fact that 13 days later, he signs. Maybe somebody actually gave him the full form by then. Who knows?
Your Honor, I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity here to clarify a little bit of the factual record here. When opposing counsel refers to this prisoner review board hearing in February, this was not an issue of the prisoner review board actually hearing Mr. Whitfield's case. If we look to the form, it was merely a continuation of Mr. Whitfield's prisoner review board hearing. So there wasn't any determination that he was eligible for release during that hearing. And Ms. Spiller was not involved in that hearing whatsoever. In fact, there's no evidence in the record that she was personally involved in anything that had to do with Mr. Whitfield's release after she responded to the January 11th grievance. That's the only evidence in the record of Ms. Spiller's personal involvement in this issue. And when it comes to the allegation that Ms. Spiller somehow was involved in the housing issue later on that summer after
I thought that was the job of her office. So are we saying she wasn't doing her office's job?
True, Your Honor, but we have to look to the standard of personal responsibility for a Section 1983 claim.
But we have evidence in the record. Of course, we all agree there's personal responsibility as a requirement, but there's some testimony that she actually has a conversation with Mr. Whitfield about this.
Your Honor, if we look in the record to the exact citation that Mr. Whitfield relies on for this supposed conversation, it is a June 2010 letter that he sent to the Prisoner Review Board, whereby he alleges that the resource department or its staff are angry at me for intentionally delaying my housing plan. That's what he says in this letter. He does not name Ms. Spiller personally, and Ms. Spiller is not a member of this resource department, nor is she the supervisor. So
Does she supervise the field services and the record office?
Your Honor, I believe that she does, but even if we look to the standard for a Section 1983 claim, we have to see a supervisor is not liable under Section 1983 merely by the nature of their role as a supervisor, but they need to provide evidence that the supervisor knew of and condoned those actions that violated the individual's constitutional rights. And we simply do not have that evidence in the record regarding Ms. Spiller's conduct across the entire board, let alone with this housing issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shull. Mr. Barnes?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to first push back against the idea that his primary concern was not signing this form. His primary complaint was that he was being asked to sign this form. When asked during Spiller understood it this way as well. When asked during her deposition whether she was aware that he believed his rights were being violated by having to sign the MSR paperwork, she responded that was the biggest part of their conversation, which was a multi-hour conversation on January 7th. And Mr. Whitfield was not, you know, whether or not Mr. Whitfield believed he didn't have to be on electronic monitoring, Mr. Whitfield would have complied with electronic monitoring, and that issue never came up. Mr. Whitfield was not released because he didn't sign a form. Spiller never raises any concern that he wasn't going to comply with his electronic monitoring conditions, or that his failure to comply with those conditions, his potential failure to comply with those conditions, played any part in her decision to not release him on January 7th. With respect to the adjustment committee, so Spiller was the one who decided to have this ticket issued, and it was marked as a major offense for failing to obey a direct order. And by characterizing it as a major offense, that's what caused the adjustment committee hearing to occur. It was her intent for the adjustment committee to punish him. She sent him to the adjustment committee to be punished, and he was punished. And the infraction he committed was the exercise of his First Amendment rights. So any punishment that the adjustment committee handed down would have been retaliatory. So she's involved in that punishment. Those 3 months are certainly attributable to her as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.